Welcome to Micro, I'm Drew Hawkins, and this episode is part of an interview series for Miami Book Fair, where members of Team Micro, that's myself, Dylan Evers, Maymay Kaufman, and Kirsten Renault, interview authors appearing at the fair about their work. For more information about their programming and to check out the incredible roster of authors appearing this year, visit miamibookfair.com. And be sure to follow them at Miami Book Fair and hashtag Miami Book Fair 2022 for more updates. Now, back to the show.
Welcome to Micro. I'm Dylan Evers, and today I'm speaking with award-winning author Ingrid Rojas Contreras. We'll be talking about her new book, The Man Who Could Move Clouds, a memoir, published in July 2022 by Doubleday. To start the show, we've asked her to select and read a passage from the book. So here's Ingrid Rojas Contreras reading from The Man Who Could Move Clouds, a memoir. Enjoy.
They say the accident that left me with temporary amnesia is my inheritance. No house or piece of land or chest of letters, just a few weeks of oblivion. Mammy had temporary amnesia as well, except where she was 8 years old, I was 23. When she fell down an empty well, I crashed my bicycle into an opening car door. When she nearly bled to death in Ocaña, Colombia, in darkness, 30 feet below the earth, I got to my feet seemingly unharmed and wandered around Chicago on a sunny winter afternoon. When she didn't know who she was for 8 months, I couldn't remember who I was for 8 weeks. They say the amnesias were door to gifts we were supposed to have, which Mami's father, Nono, neglected to pass. Nono was a curandero. His gifts were instructions for talking to the dead, telling the future, healing the ill, and moving the clouds. We were brown people, mestizo. European men had arrived on the continent and violated indigenous women, and that was our origin, neither native nor Spanish, but a wound. We called the gifts secrets. In the mountains of Santander, the fathers had passed the secrets to the sons, who passed the secrets to the sons, who passed the secrets to the sons. And none of his sons, Nono said, had the testículos required to be a real curandero. Only Mami, strong-willed, unafraid, more of a man than most men in his eyes, whom he liked to call mi animal de monte, could have housed the gifts. But Mami was a woman, and such things were forbidden. If a woman came to possess the secrets, it was said that misfortune would soon follow. Yet, as 8-year-old Mami recovered from her injuries after falling down the well, and as her memories returned, it so happened that from wherever her mind had gone, she brought back the ability to see ghosts and hear disembodied voices. The family says Mami was destined for the secrets, and since Nono couldn't teach them to her, the secrets had come directly to her. 4 decades later, when I suffered my accident and lost my memory, the family was thrilled. Diaz poured drinks, told one another with an air of festivity, there it goes again, the snake biting its own tail. And then they waited to see how exactly the secrets would manifest in me. This is a story that happens in Spanish, when Mami and the Tías call each other vos, the archaic thou, but they use tú with me, the informal, tender you. Theirs is the way of speaking in Ocaña, where our family is from, and where language can sound like a colonial fossil. In Spanish, our stories are slow, then fast, and we cackle constantly. Mami and I are spooked by the way our lives echo each other's, so we don't often discuss our amnesias, but increasingly, this is an itch I must scratch. I scrape and scold at its touch, only to want to probe into it again. The Tías asked me to tell them what it was like to live without a memory. I focus on trying to communicate how surreal it was, how cinematic. The Tías roll their eyes at me, but they do so while looking at one another like I am a bad television show they are watching and can safely comment on. Such a gringa, no? What they really want to know is what I dreamt. For Mami and for me, during our bouts of amnesia, our waking lives were punctuated by a constant state of confusion, but our dreams were grounding. Mommy's dreams were sequential, and in her dreams, she was a ghost. In mine, I had no body, and as I say this to the tías out loud, I realize I too believed I was a ghost. We have a word in Spanish for the walking of the dead, desandar, to unwalk, to walk until the walking is worn thin, to walk until the walking undoes even itself. That ghosts have a particular way of walking is an idea we inherited from the settlers who invaded the continent, but what is intrinsically ours is the sense of porosity, an understanding that we live between the real and unreal, and that often they are the one and the same. So to us, the living go on ghost walks too.
Thank you very much. Can you please tell me why you chose that passage?
I guess it's the one that opens the book, and it's such a complicated narrative that I often will sometimes read from the beginning, just because it does, I think, a good job at launching the story. It's also a chapter that the first chapter is one that I worked on for a long time, maybe 7 years before I actually like worked on the rest of the book. So I'm very fond of the beginning.
Yeah, that's actually a section that I underlined the ghost walk part. So I recently saw your Twitter thread about the organizational structure of your memoir. You described the structural mapping, and I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about the process of creating this structure.
Yeah, I'm usually a writer who doesn't like to have too much of a plan as I'm drafting, but it's so I like to just show up to the page when it's early on and just do whatever feels right. At some point when I hit about page 100 is when I get completely lost, and that's when I need a map, and that's when I need a structure. So initially I went through all of these series of mapping as I was working on the book, and one of them had to do with, it was just like the simplest structure that was just, you know, we begin with like the unearthing of my grandfather, which is part of what the memoir is about, is traveling back to Colombia and doing the disinterment of my grandfather's body. And then ending with, you know, what happens at the end when we have unearthed the body. And then throughout, the structure of it started to get so complicated, and I started to think about poetic arguments as a way to organize the stories that were in there. The book does switch a lot in time, but there's the connective tissue between everything sometimes is a repeating story. So something happens in my mother's life, and then there's some strange mirror that, you know, that same story happening in my life, or my grandfather's life. And other times it's I'm thinking about words as symbol, and I'm thinking about how the symbol is developing throughout the memoir. So I just created like this just very involved, intense map, tracking all of the symbols. I just kind of like in the end printed all the new kind of order that I had made based on the poetic argument, and cut each line out, and then just kind of like rewove it into an order. And then that's what I used to edit the book.
And so you physically wove basically your whole memoir together based on ideas. And I find that really incredible. And then you described your mother telling you to switch two sections. Can you talk about that?
So sometimes my mother will say, "What are you up to?" And instead of answering, I will just take a photo of what I'm doing and send it to her. So this was one of the ways I was doing this restructuring, and I just happened to send her a photo of what I was doing. And I think by then I had done this simplified map on a different piece of paper so that I knew what to move where. And she said, "This is wrong." And she doesn't, you know, her understanding of English is very rudimentary at best. And yet she just told me like two things were out of order, and she told me to switch them. And I, you know, I anytime that my mother does something like that, I think that it's so pretentious and so annoying. And then when I actually was thinking about what she was asking me to do when I was, you know, actually entertaining, oh, what happens if I move this chapter here? I was like, this solves all of my problems.
Right. So not only did you physically weave the structure together into a tapestry, but you've also used a lot of other physical elements to create this memoir. Your Polaroid camera to capture images that are in the book, and also your typewriter.
Yes, yeah.
So what is it about this like physicality that really speaks to you?
Yeah, I think sometimes when I'm at the computer, I can access one way of thinking. And you know, the reason why I wanted to physically, you know, do a weaving of the structure, you know, print it out and then reweave the order, was that I think that when I do things physically, I access a different way of thinking. It's almost like I'm thinking with my whole body as opposed to just with my brain. So just sometimes it just really makes things possible for me, or it really opens doors, or I come up with solutions that I wouldn't have otherwise. I think maybe it just involves abstract. I can get more access into the abstract thinking that way. You know, I imagine that because it's I'm trying to think with my body and intuition as opposed to. I think oftentimes when I'm at the computer, I just feel like a giant brain typing, you know. So I think with, you know, when I'm using the typewriter, it's just such a physical exercise, and the speed in which I am writing is very different. So my sentences end up sounding very different just because I can type so quickly on the computer. And so it's actually it changes the composition, I think. But yeah, but it yeah, I love to do all of these. I think I just really love to involve the body, because I there's another kind of intelligence there that lives in the body.
And so much of your memoir is about the connection or even disconnect between the mind and the body, and what the body remembers but the mind forgets, and those memory lagoons. And so it really is a sort of different way of knowing, and you describe that
Yeah.
really well in this memoir.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that I've just always been really struck, and I especially after losing my memory and then figuring out that even though I didn't have in my mind a memory of someone or of something, that sometimes my body had some kind of sort of collected memory of that person or of a place. That I didn't, and I found that to be so fascinating. Yeah, so I think that there is really, you know, often what I feel is that our bodies know the things that we don't know yet. So sometimes it, you know, your body kind of knows something and you have to catch up to it. Yeah.
So much of this book describes the living document of oral storytelling, from generation to generation and from person to person. How do you feel now that you've committed these stories to like the printed page? Do you ever want to keep expanding upon them?
I kind of do. And I don't know, you know, like I have been working on some short stories. And I do feel that maybe that's, I do feel that I am expanding on what I wrote in the memoir in some way. But you know, but it's too early to tell. But I think my intention is that I, with writing the memoir, there was just such a richness in the orality of my family and the village where I'm from, where my family is from, that putting it down in a book to me felt so important. Just be also because things are changing so quickly, and I think I just really wanted to preserve it in some way by writing the book. And now that I've done that, I really kind of, there's so many things, still that I learned in that trip, or that I uncovered, or stories that I heard about my grandfather and my mother as traditional healers that didn't fit into the book, because it didn't fit the poetic argument that I was trying to make that we were talking about earlier. But yeah, so I think that maybe my next project would be to expand into it, but in fiction.
Oh, okay. Wow. So what has the speaking of your family and the people that you spoke to, what has the reception been like so far for that first row, as you said in another interview, of your audience for the people who you're speaking to with this work?
So my dad has a copy. I don't know if he started to read yet. My sister also has a copy, and I think she has started to read. And I told my mother the story out loud because she's just allergic to books. She does not like reading. If you force her to read anything, she'll be like, why was I born? I shouldn't be doing this, But with her, what I did is I early on when I before the book came out, I called her on the phone and I did an oral telling of the memoir. So I just called her and I kind of, was like chapter one, and then just, as I was flipping the pages, I was summarizing what was in there. So she's gotten the story that way.
That's another layer of the storytelling. So, the novel
Yeah.
keeps going. That's great.
Yeah.
During your writing process, are you normally which language are you normally writing in? Is it English? Is it Spanish? Is it both?
I guess it depends on what language I'm surrounded by. So when I'm in Colombia, I'm visiting my parents who live now in Mexico City, and I'm surrounded by Spanish, I find that I start to just write in Spanish. It's almost like I love to wake up in that texture of language, the street sounds and all of the things that come in and out of your consciousness. And I think that it does really influence or affect me, or I start to think about the music of what I'm hearing and then just wanting to do something with it. But yeah, but now that when I'm in the US and I spend most of my time in the US, so I tend to write in English for that reason more.
Okay. You've said that your amnesia was absolutely life-altering. Could you talk a little bit about how this experience changed your writing and also your desire to write this memoir in particular?
How did it change my writing? One of the things that happened with amnesia is that I think that before amnesia, I had such a strong connection to language and to words, and I almost would make an emotional hierarchy of language would be at the top and experience would be kind of subservient to it. And I think during amnesia, what I discovered is that I was feeling so many things that didn't have words, or perhaps that I, also another thing that was happening was that I couldn't remember a lot of the words for things. And so I was often in this space of not having the words for something, but that didn't feel like a loss, but because it allowed me to kind of dwell in the experience of what I was feeling in a way that is very different when it's mediated through language. So I think through amnesia, I just fell in love with that wordless stage, when you're just living in the emotion of something, or you're living kind of in the middle of an experience, and you're not, and like no language is forming, but you're just there. So I really kind of started to see the value and the peace of that. But and later when I recovered my memory, I'm still a writer. I'm still someone who loves language and loves to create. combinations and experiment with sounds, and for me to experiment across languages and try to use like Spanish grammar on English and see what happens. And yeah, but I think that part of me, now that I've been through amnesia, has this reverence for when we don't have the words for something, or like how sometimes that is the most precise way to say something. I'm making square quotes to say something than to actually kind of give it language. So I think now I'm maybe more a writer that sees the contradiction in the act of writing.
I think somewhere in the final chapter, you were talking about how the writing of it, is not the final component. It's, it's everything. It's the experience of it. So,
And I think as far as the I think that I as far as the book goes and like writing the memoir, the experience of amnesia really kind of told me, gave me the, I think, the tone with how the book should be written. Because before, I think I had tried to write this, a similar story or some of the stories of my grandfather before, and I kept getting caught up in how other people were receiving what I was saying. So I would kind of like hear a lot of, sometimes it would be very corrective, like, oh, but what you're writing is a fiction story, is some, something that people would tell me. And so I think I just kind of kept getting caught up in like, what are the politics of how people are hearing the story and how should I deal with that? And I think during amnesia, when I, these memories of like my grandfather's stories and my mother's stories came back, they weren't mediated by a worry of how they would be received, but I just kind of received them, as if for the first time. And so I had this opportunity to just really hear them and make my own opinion about them, or make my own value system appreciation of them without any kind of, I don't know, tinkering or manipulation from anything outside of that. And so I think because of that, there was a way in which I was telling myself those stories, because when you remember something, it's a way that you're telling yourself a story. I could hear the tone that I had always wanted, or I could hear the way that I was telling it to myself. I was like, that's the way that it should be told. So really kind of amnesia just gave me, it just opened the right door for me to be able to tell it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so as someone who loves to identify symbols, connections, layers in text, I was absolutely mesmerized and impressed by the intricacy of your themes. And I know that you've talked about like the ideas and how you wove them together. But one that may be more subtle, but one that really did stand out was color. It came up in some of the strongest scenes, the black well, the black dress, the white ashes, the white cows, even the white room. Was this really intentional?
It came out of the my listening to the story. So I when I was writing my mother's accident and my accident, there's a chapter in the book that tells them at the same time. So even though they're, 30 something years apart, I really love the idea of shrinking time and then telling these two events together. So what I the process of that was that I would write, a chunk of what had happened to me, and then I would edit, because I think I had some of that material before. And then I would call my mother and I would ask her about just a small part of the story of how she had fallen into the well. So at some point when I was doing that and I was asking her to describe you know, what was the attraction of this empty well that she had looked into, you know, the one that she fell into. And she was just describing like the blackness of it and how, you know, the reason why she had gone to kind of go look into this well was that she had been told like it's going to be the blackest black that you will ever see in your life. And that to her, she was 8 years old, was like very, you know, entrancing, and she couldn't wait. So then, you know, I kind of like hung up with her, and then I was just you know, putting into the text the next part of my accident, which was when I was on my way to pick up this, it was a black dress, and I was obsessed with this black dress, which I still have, is when somebody like opened their car door into the bike lane, and that's when I crashed, and that was my accident that resulted in amnesia. So because I was putting the two together and I was writing them that way, I just immediately noticed the theme of the black, the yeah. black and the black.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what that meant is that anytime that I was, you know, going forward in the story, anytime that the color black would come up, I would pay close attention, and I would try to see if there was a connection of that black to the black of the well, or to the
mm-hmm.
black of the dress.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could see a connection, then I would kind of try to write it that way, so
yeah.
that the reader might get like that sense
yeah.
of
yeah.
this is a building theme in this memoir.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that theme. So that was my next question. What became of the dress? You still have it?
I still have it. I, you know, like, my, yeah, my mother said, you know, don't, I sent her a photo of it. And my mother said, you know, don't go near this dress. Like, this dress has something bad will happen around this black dress. It's going to turn you into a widow. And I didn't listen to her. And, you know, of course, then I had my accident that resulted in amnesia. And yeah, I, as far as I'm concerned, I feel like if it was going to do something, it already did it. Do you know what I mean? Like it,
yeah.
it's almost like it had one curse on it or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
and so like, you know, like the battery of the curse has run out.
So could you tell me a little bit about what you were reading when you were writing this memoir? And I know that within the memoir, there are some books, you know, that you pick up. There are some things that you consult. But what are some of the things that you kind of came back to or used when you were writing this?
Let's see. I think Woman Warrior was one that I reread again while I was writing the memoir. And I was very interested in the way that book is kind of folding, you know, family storytelling back into the memoir,
mm-hmm.
and it's folding ghost stories back into the memoir. So I was very interested in that book for that reason. And it's a book that I just deeply love and admire. I was also reading a lot of kind of sociology and ethnographies
mm-hmm.
Of Colombia. I read The History of the Mirror, which is one of the themes that I was developing for the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just called The Mirror. And I was reading a lot of poetry. And I think that when I'm drafting, I find that if I read like too much in the genre that I'm writing in,
mm-hmm.
that somehow I start to get stuck. Maybe because I start to notice like, oh, what did this person do? What should I do? And I just kind of get stuck in that.
Mm-hmm.
So I really love to read outside of the genre that I'm working on.
Oh.
And then I'm just kind of in a maybe like a language field where I'm just admiring language, and I'm just excited about ideas, and mm-hmm. I'm not getting caught up on, oh, this person did it this way, what should I do?
Right.
Type of thing.
Yeah, it's maybe more intuitive and less like self-aware or
yeah,
being
yeah.
as you write, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think I try to be as like the least self-aware when I'm writing, so that I can just write, you know, maybe like the true form of what the book wants to be, as opposed to having a fully formed idea of what it should be.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so my final and much less serious question is, are you dressing up for Halloween?
I am. I have this, it's like this lacy kind of widow outfit, but I'm going to add roller skates.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think I'm going to try, you know how there's like these roller skate girls who would like deliver food?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to have a tray and I'm going to be delivering like poisons is what I think. It's just going to be like a mashup of.
That's great. I love it.
Are a mashup of things.
Are you a good skater?
Yeah. I'm not like amazing, but I can skate and dance.
So. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. That's really cool.
Are you dressing up?
Yeah, my whole family, we're going to be Vikings because my 4-year-old picked that out. So, yeah. but yeah, you're in San Francisco, right? Are there places to skate that aren't super hilly?
There are some places. I'm going to a friend's house. A friend is, I think she's maybe having a party at her art studio. So it's going to be flat.
Yeah. Sorry, I've never been. All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, and especially about this wonderful memoir. It's really, really remarkable.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I very much appreciate that. Thank you.
Be sure to stop by and see Ingrid Rojas Contreras at Miami Book Fair, November 13 to 20 in beautiful Miami, Florida, and pick up a copy of her incredible memoir, The Man Who Could Move Clouds, a memoir.